From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. After days of brutal winter weather, states like Utah, Florida, Washington, New Jersey, and New York are not getting shipments of vaccines that they desperately need today. The country's top infectious disease expert, Anthony Fauci, addressed the problem on MSNBC.
It's been slowed down in some places, going to a grinding halt. We're just going to have to make up for it as soon as the weather lifts a bit, the ice melts, and we can get the trucks out and the people out and getting the vaccine into people's arms. We're going to just have to make up for it, namely do double time when this thing clears up.
And these storms aren't just a problem for vaccination efforts. Dozens of people have died and millions of people spent days without power. And now in Texas, millions more are still without clean drinking water. Alma Roberts lives in southwest Houston and is one of more than 14 million people trying to cope with no running water. And Alma joins us now. Welcome.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yes, we are very sorry to hear what you're going through. What are you doing for water right now?
I have a small kettle, so we have been boiling water. We are running out fast. We had a little bit of resource, and I went ventured out as soon as it was safe a couple days ago to a local store, waited in line. But we're using the last of our drinking water for cooking, for washing dishes, the necessities.
Yeah, you've also been taking baths out of this water, and you've had to wait in line at stores. There are lots of other people in your same situation.
Absolutely. I actually haven't ventured out the last couple days, but I hear it's, pretty dire. When people find stores, they post it on Facebook or to scramble right now to get groceries, water, anything.
Yeah, this is compounded by the fact that you were without power for several days. The grocery situation, the food situation is really a big deal because shipments have not been able to come in. How are you doing when it comes to being able to have a stocked fridge during all of this?
Well, the reality is we don't. I think people are going through their pantry items. I'm sure the kids are tired of bread. We're out of bread, actually. But we've been going through pantry items. There's really not fresh food. I actually, the food that we picked up at this grocery store, it was a little kind of Mexican dive store that I went to. I'm not sure, if it was thawed out. I'm not sure how fresh it was, to be honest with you. But, we cooked it almost, we cooked it pretty well. And that's what we had for breakfast.
You're also trying to figure all of this out is your husband and oldest son. You have three kids total. Your oldest son has to go out to work today, every day. They're police officers and haven't had a day off. What are they telling you about the strain of their jobs when they come home each day?
It's a loaded question for me. I mean, my youngest finished the academy a couple months ago. He's actually being evaluated this week. And it's under a lot of stress. And I'm hoping they're a little compassionate. He's doing at least 12, 14 hour shifts, very little sleep. He's desperate to take a bath. It's really hard times. One of the things my husband commented on is that they just don't have the resources. Like with previous storms or hurricanes, that there's some infrastructure in place. They can take showers or they bring them meals. And in this case, well, that's not the case this time. So Tanya, they don't complain. These guys, I think they're proud to do what they do, and this is what they're built for, times like these. So they're fine.
This isn't the first time you've dealt with disaster. Your home was severely damaged during Hurricane Harvey back in 2017. What's getting you and those you love through?
My neighbors. We've been successful, I think, by, I'm saying successful. We've been getting by, I think, by sharing with other families. My son's girlfriend, her mother, her grandmother, they've been over. They brought celery and, carrots, and I had chicken, so we put a stew together. It's been amazing to have them over. It's also been, I think, encouraging, that we're not the only ones to have company with the COVID isolation on top of everything else. Just having people over, just forging ahead. Mm.
Have you been given a timeline for when your water could be back on?
Well, the mayor's saying that Monday at the latest. So, really, we started getting water yesterday. Then the water pressure started improving by last night. So this morning, it's going to be a week for me to get through the dishes and laundry. But I don't trust the water yet. So they're saying Sunday, Monday at the latest.
A lot of us who are not there
are talking about the political ramifications of all of this, what the leaders in Texas may have done or have not done to mitigate something like this, to stop something like this from happening. What do you want politicians and those in charge to know as you literally from day to day are just trying to figure out what to do next?
This is tough. I mean, I don't like, you know, pointing fingers or the blame game, especially, you know, between parties and things like that. But I do think, you know, leaders have responsibility. And a part of me, and I know this is probably not great, but a part of me wishes that their families or that they personally were going through it. Because what I've learned from the previous floods, like you mentioned, is that if you're not going through it, it's really hard to be empathetic. People just detach from the situation. You know, they might feel bad or like it on a social media, but they're not out there helping you. Or if these leaders or people in these positions could feel some of the frustration, you know, the financial ramifications, the personal, you know, losses, it's just, I think that they would be in a better position to help out.
Yeah, at this point, that's all that you all are doing is you're helping each other out. You're all each other has at this point.
That's right.
Oma, I thank you for taking the time to talk with us during this difficult time, and we wish you all the best.
Thank you so much.
That's Oma Roberts, who lives in Southwest Houston. She is one of the 14 million people still without water.
Well, starting today, asylum seekers who'd been sent back to Mexico by the Trump administration will be allowed into the United States as they wait for immigration courts to process their case. President Biden reversed Trump's migrant protection protocols, also known as the Remain in Mexico policy, which over the past 2 years kept more than 65,000 asylum seekers out of the U.S. and forced many into squalid camps on the Mexican side of the border. But as of today, U.S. officials will begin processing a few hundred cases at the San Ysidro port of entry at the border between Tijuana and San Diego. And that's where KPBS reporter Max Rivlin Nadler is now. Max, welcome. What's the scene like there today?
People have been lining up at the port of entry for a few days. I spoke with one woman who's been online here for 3 days. She came from Honduras. She's been living in Mexico now for 2 years, waiting for her chance to claim asylum in the United States. So right now there's around 200 people outside of the port of entry, and mostly they're just looking for information.
Wow. And tell me more about how this process will work. Who's eligible to come into the United States now?
Right now, it's only people who were sent back to Mexico under the Remain in Mexico program, which sent people back to Mexico to wait while their asylum claims were processed in the U.S. They came to the U.S. for court, but court stopped at the beginning of the pandemic. So people have been waiting for almost a year now for those court dates to begin. Only a few thousand people in Tijuana right now remaining were part of that program. A lot of the people that have come today were not part of that program, were never enrolled, and right now would not qualify to be processed for asylum under this new program.
I see. Well, as you say, people seeking asylum have been waiting for a very long time for this day to come. Tell me more about the conversations you're having with migrants there on the border, how they're feeling, and what they've gone through all this time while they've been waiting.
Yeah, so like you mentioned before, conditions in Tijuana have been really difficult for asylum seekers. I spoke with one individual, Gerson Colon. He also came from Honduras. He's been in Tijuana now for at least a year with his wife and two young children. And this is what he told me has been difficult about living in Mexico.
Fue muy difícil, dado que nosotros, al no tener documentos,
He says it's difficult because he doesn't have Mexican documents. And on top of that, the Mexican police have been giving people problems. So asylum seekers in Tijuana, like Orson, they live in a really kind of liminal space. They don't have legal status. They're not allowed to work. They have to work in the informal economy. And they're often victimized by both local police and local criminal groups. He was speaking to me from a shelter that he himself has only felt marginally safe at. And so people are really desperate to get their cases moving. And again, he's one of the lucky ones because he was sent back to Mexico under this program. He plans on signing up through a website that the government has put up to allow him to move his case forward and get a date that he will show up at the port of entry.
But Max, as people around the world hear stories like this and they see that the migrant camps are beginning to clear out around the border, what's the risk that more people will start to come in large numbers to the border seeking asylum or just trying to get in?
So the fact of the matter is that actually migration to the southern border of the United States never really slowed down. There were those large groups in 2018, but people have been coming from places like Cameroon, Haiti, Central America, as always, in large numbers. They just haven't been allowed in. They've been expelled under this thing called Title 42 that the Trump administration put in place. So the idea may be that, oh, if the door swings open, more people will come. Well, there's already quite a few people who have been coming even when the door was closed.
And briefly, where will people go and what will they do once they cross the border? You know, the Trump administration, those who wanted tighter controls on immigration, are worried that they'll just get lost in the interior of the country.
Yeah, so a lot of them are going to go to sponsors or family. They're going to be given alternatives to detention. So they'll be given ankle bracelets. They'll have court dates they'll be followed up on. And we'll find out whether they'll be able to actually claim asylum in the U.S.
Max Rivlin-Nadler, a reporter for member station KPBS at the San Ysidro Port of Entry near San Diego. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
The CDC reports more than 42 million Americans have received at least one dose of the COVID-19 vaccine. Virginia is one of the leaders. It's administered a higher percentage of its shots than many other states. But some Virginians are still frustrated with the pace of the rollout. Sam Turkin of member station WHRO explains why they're crossing state lines to get a shot.
When the first batch of vaccines went out to states in December, John and his wife thought they'd get theirs pretty soon. He's 73, she's 68.
My wife is a heart attack survivor and a cancer survivor. Two considerable pre-existing conditions in our mind should have popped her to the top of the list.
Instead, they got word that they could wait more than a month for their shots. John lives in Virginia Beach. He asked that we only use his first name to protect his privacy. A couple weeks ago, John heard that a clinic in northeastern North Carolina was giving vaccines to Virginians. He and his wife quickly registered, got their shots 2 days later. No problem.
It was an enormous relief. Just the sensation of getting back in the car and going, wow, we got vaccinated.
Other Southeast Virginians have also heard about the North Carolina option. Last week, former Virginia Governor George Allen posted on Twitter that he got his first dose there. So did Susan in Norfolk. She also wanted to protect her privacy, so no last name. Susan is 64 and says she got her vaccine at a drive-through site in Currituck County a few weeks ago.
I had doubts almost the time the needle was in my arm. By the time we got in line, every time somebody came to the window, I thought they were going to say, you can't be here, for either my age or my license plate.
The vaccines are a federal resource distributed to states, according to North Carolina health officials. That means they can't restrict access to the shots based on jurisdiction, even state borders. I drove down to Currituck County to see for myself.
I'm at a park where they're giving out vaccines. There's a long line of cars. I'm seeing some cars with Virginia license plates. I've seen two so far. That's three, four.
North Carolina officials wouldn't tell me how many Virginians have been vaccinated there, but it's definitely a topic of conversation around Virginia. On the neighborhood social networking site next door, residents post and argue about the fastest way to get a vaccine. And that desperation for shots comes with criticism of Virginia's rollout. During a recent news briefing, Governor Ralph Northam said the frustration is justified.
We still have a long way to go. I don't want to sugarcoat that because I know everyone is feeling impatient.
It's not surprising that people are going to look to get a vaccine where they can get it.
Professor Vivian Reifberg studies the economics of healthcare at the University of Virginia. She says so-called vaccine tourism is happening across the country because some areas are getting shots out faster than others. They also may have fewer restrictions or just a smoother process for booking appointments. Reifberg says the benefit is that more people are getting vaccinated. Still, the federal government distributes vaccines based on state populations. So when people get their shots in another state,
it can confuse the allocation system. Also, it may not be as equitable for those people who are not in a position to travel easily, to take a day off.
A Maryland spokesman says there's evidence Virginians are getting vaccines there too. Officials in both states asked that residents get their shots in their home state. What's your response to all of that?
I actually have some personal recriminations about potentially taking a vaccine out of the arm of a North Carolina resident for whom it was intended.
That's John again, the guy from Virginia Beach who got his shot in North Carolina. John believes he got the vaccine because there weren't enough locals who wanted it. At least that's what he hopes. He wouldn't disclose the name of the clinic. Despite his reservations, he's scheduled to get his second dose there. For Here and Now, I'm Sam Turkin in Norfolk, Virginia.
On any given Sunday, in 42 cities throughout the country, you might spot an organized group of Black people hiking or skiing or bird watching. These groups are part of a larger collective called Outdoor Afro, a nonprofit organization that's aimed at reclaiming nature for Black people. Now, with the pandemic, the group is larger than ever, defying the misconceptions that Black people just aren't into nature. It's a stereotype rooted in the fact that for a long time, Black people were denied access to outdoor spaces. Rue Mapp founded Outdoor Afro to fight that stereotype, and she joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
You know the stereotypes, Rue. Black people don't camp. Black people don't swim. Black people don't go outdoors. I mean, that's not true for you or for those who have joined Outdoor Afro. When did you personally fall in love with hiking and camping?
Well, I grew up in a nature-loving household, and also I was a Girl Scout, and I was an Outward Bound student, and I could see throughout my life the role that nature played that helped me to become more confident, more strong, and, you know, just healthier. And as I got into more backcountry activities away from the city, I just didn't see enough people who looked like me. And I also noticed that we had a representation problem. And that's what Outdoor Afro set out to be back in 2009 as a blog from my kitchen table to tell a new story and to break those stereotypes.
To break those stereotypes, but as you were saying, there are some practical benefits on a personal level that reclaiming the outdoors gives you. Can you lay that out a little bit?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things about the outdoors, especially in this last year with the pandemic, I was just so thankful to be a part of what was a solution for people, and that was to get outside and connect with nature, where we could go out among those trees. And, you know, those trees, they don't know what color you are. And those birds are going to sing no matter how much money is in your account. Those flowers are going to bloom. And so for me, the outdoors has represented not only a way to get more healthy and more connected with who you are, but it's also a place to experience freedom.
Okay, to your point that birds don't see color, trees don't see color, after the death of Ahmaud Arbery in May, he was a Black man jogging in Georgia when he was killed by two white men. We spoke with James Ravenel. He's the co-founder of Black Runners Connection. And he talked about how even when he's outdoors, he's constantly aware of his presence and how it's perceived. I mean, he wears bright colors. He tries to make noise to let people know he's coming so they aren't startled by him. Do you ever get to a point outdoors where you're not in that dual state of consciousness?
Well, you know, one of the things that Outdoor Afro set out to do was to find ways to meet people where they are. And we realized that there were some practical barriers. And one of those barriers was about fears and perceptions of not only what might crawl on you or bite you in nature, but also about other people. And so one of the ways that we responded in creating a program that's the Outdoor Afro Leadership Team, a group of 90 volunteer men and women leading people out in nature all over the country, is that people felt more comfortable getting out in groups. You know, you see these iconic photographs of a singular person standing out over a sweeping vista. And, you know, the way that our community likes to get outside is in groups. And so we meet people at that need, and we find that people's confidence and their nature swagger improves, where people can feel a lot more comfortable going outside and doing things by themselves. But people need to be supported, they need mentorship. And I find that people are getting out over and over beyond their time with Outdoor Afro. And that's the change we've been so proud to see.
nature swagger. I love that. As part of Black History Month, you're spotlighting Black people in history who are outdoorsmen and women. Why are these stories so important to tell?
We have so many people in our community who are absolutely nature leaders, people who we wouldn't necessarily think of as nature leaders. And one of my personal favorites, actually, is Harriet Tubman. I mean, one of the things that people don't realize is that, you know, she was not only an entrepreneur, but she absolutely was a wilderness leader. That in the cover of night, she had to understand the stars. She had to understand wildlife, how they called. She was reading the moss on trees.
Rue, I have never thought about it this way.
Well, I mean, and that's part of, you know, what we do as Outdoor Afro is we are, you know, harvesting these stories, not only from the famous figures that we all are familiar with, but people who are in our own families. And, you know, I think about my dad, you know, who, you know, loved the outdoors and considered himself a cowboy. And we used to recycle things and we used to lay things up. And, you know, he would have probably never called himself a conservationist or even an environmentalist. And so much of our work is about telling this new narrative.
You've given us some good tips to develop our nature swagger, but depending on where you live, access to the natural world can really be hard. I mean, what can you recommend for people listening who want to start to reconnect with nature, but maybe they're not anywhere close to a park or other outdoor places?
Well, see, that's the part that I also want to help people understand is that nature is everywhere. And so we have to reimagine that nature access is really right outside your window, right on your fire escape, your apartment balcony, outside your front door, and that you can tap into that nature. It's all around us and everyone can access it.
Rue Mapp, CEO and founder of Outdoor Afro, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
In recent mass shootings, people have been targeted for who they are or who they worship. But on June 28, 2018, people were targeted for the job they do at a newspaper. Listen to the new series from NPR's Embedded about the survivors at the Capital Gazette.
The energy crisis that brought Texas to its knees this week is creating ripple effects around the country. The price of natural gas soared after the record-breaking cold snap froze gas wells in places like Oklahoma and Texas. And then prices suddenly crashed, at one point tanking by 99% at a distribution hub in Oklahoma. Industry analysts worry these shortages could drag on for weeks, long after the oil and gas pipelines thaw out. Mike Regan is senior editor for Bloomberg News. He's been following this story. Mike, good to speak with you.
You too, Peter.
And for some context here, Texas produces about a quarter of all the natural gas in the country, and production there is down by more than 30% this week. So what's the state of the market right now?
So natural gas prices have gone up. As you pointed out, in some locations, they've just really skyrocketed and then crashed back down. But nationally, they haven't really gone through the roof, up to about a little more than $3 per million BTUs currently. And the reason is that, Peter, natural gas like oil is stored in inventories, and those inventories tend to really swell ahead of the winter, and then they get drawn down throughout the winter. And because there's less demand for energy because of the pandemic, those inventories were pretty high for this time of year. So that, to some degree, has kept the nationwide rise in prices in check. But I do think that's because the market is viewing this, luckily, as a temporary event. You know, if this had happened, say, in December, early in the winter, when we needed gas for the rest of the winter, I think we'd be looking at a much more dire situation. But luckily, since we're towards the end of the winter, when gas prices tend to come down, they are going up now. But the light is sort of at the end of the tunnel. So the market's kind of hoping and thinking this is a temporary event and not getting as freaked out about it as it would if it were, say, earlier in the winter.
Okay, well, that is good to hear. Now, Texas relies on natural gas to power its energy grid, which is why the production problems left millions of people in the dark and in the cold this week. And on Wednesday, the governor of Texas, Greg Abbott, ordered producers not to export natural gas out of Texas until February 21st. What do you make of a choice like that? What does it mean for Texas and the rest of the country?
So, there's a lot of debate about whether he actually has the authority to do this. The Commerce Clause of the U.S. Constitution basically prohibits state governments from interfering in interstate trade like that. But Governor Abbott says, he had to make a disaster declaration because of this, and he thinks that gives him the latitude to impose these type of restrictions. And it's a kind of an open question that I think would have to be settled in courts, which obviously would take a long time. But in the meantime, energy producers were basically following this order of his to stop exporting gas.
All right. Natural gas output, it's slowly starting to come back online as things slowly start to warm up. But I'm hearing that it still could take a few weeks to get back to normal. Why is that?
So, Peter, when you extract natural gas, it's from oil wells, and there is usually water vapor involved that is released in the process. And obviously, in these conditions, that vapor is freezing inside the pipes and other parts of the infrastructure. So it's kind of like when a pipe freezes in your house. It could burst that pipe, cause a lot of damage. So what needs to be done is not only for these pipes to thaw out, but for crews to go in and make the necessary repairs. And that's going to take a while.
Mike Regan at Bloomberg News, thank you so much.
Thank you, Peter.
There are quite a few controversies from the 90s we think we know the whole story about. The abuse allegations against Michael Jackson, the O.J. Simpson trial, and the story of Mia Farrow and Woody Allen. Well, a new documentary series, Allen vs. Farrow, takes a deep dive into details most of us were not privy to back then. And through their story, the documentary takes a hard look at how our society treats people in power and those who accuse them of abuse. Woody Allen is famously known for having a relationship and later marrying Mia Farrow's college-aged daughter, Suni. And during that time, he was also accused of sexually abusing the couple's daughter, Dylan Farrow, who was 7 years old when the accusations came to light. Here's a bit of an interview from the documentary with Dylan, looking back on her childhood feelings for Woody Allen.
I worshipped him. He was so funny, and he made me feel so special. That's where things get really, really complicated.
Allen has denied abusing both Suni and Dylan Farrow. And Allen versus Farrow directors Kirby Dick and Amy Ziering join me now. And Kirby, it was an interview with Dylan Farrow that your producer Amy Hurdy did with her during the Me Too movement a few years ago that convinced you to dig into this story. Tell us more.
Well, obviously I was aware of this for all the way through the 90s and into the present. But because there was so much coverage of it, I thought, is there anything new here to learn? But Amy's, did the first interview with Dylan Farrow, and that interview was so powerful, so strong, it became very apparent that the whole story wasn't being told.
Well, let's unpack that a little bit, because there are a lot of themes explored in this documentary. Number one is the exploration of power. We know that Woody Allen is a very powerful man, and at the time, he was the toast of the town in New York City. Our understanding of what family sexual abuse can look like, and really our rudimentary understanding of how a child can articulate that abuse. And then our depictions and assessment of women who make accusations of abuse. I mean, Mia Farrow was painted as a vindictive and really possibly hysterical ex-lover who coached her daughter to tell untrue stories of sexual abuse. Amy, what was your perception of Mia Farrow?
Mia was incredibly reluctant, did not want to do these interviews, said no to Amy Hurdy several times. And then Dylan sort of said, Mom, I totally get it, and I get why you're reluctant, and I respect that, but it would mean a lot to me if you just spoke to them, because I have confidence that it's not going to be the same. And so Mia did finally agree, was not pleased about it, was very scared. And in fact, she showed up in a black sweatshirt, and I looked at her and she looked at me, and I knew, like, we were lucky that she even showed up. And so I didn't want to press the point, but I said, would you mind, you know, maybe wearing my blouse? And I gave her my blouse and took a t-shirt from one of the crew members, and we did the interview. And so it's a funny anecdote, and I learned recently that to this day she calls me the silk blouse lady. But it just underlines for, I know that I only found out about recently. It underlines for me, just for people who think, oh, Mia's doing this, you know, all the narratives we heard, you know, she's vindictive, she's the publicity hound, you know, she's crazy, et cetera. No, actually, she never wanted to speak and, like, you know, didn't even have any kind of vanity going through her mind when she showed up in the interview.
You know, Dylan was very introspective. She speaks quite candidly in this film of her early childhood memories. Here she is talking about how Woody Allen would give her special attention. Let's listen.
I remember every morning he would read the comic section with me. And on the days that he wasn't there, he would actually leave me little notes and comics for me to find at the breakfast table. He took me to my first Broadway musical, Guys and Dolls, and he explained the entire thing to me, so I understood it.
But it was much more than special treatment. I mean, everyone you all talk to, babysitters and friends and teachers and therapists, say Woody Allen had this intense focus on Dylan. Kirby, can you describe a little of that in the context of these greater accusations?
Well, yes. This started very early, you know, Woody Allen's intense focus or obsession with Dylan, to the extent that he would isolate her from other children and sort of demand that the two of them be alone together. At first, Mia and actually the family and, you know, close friends all thought, well, this is wonderful. Woody Allen has always in the past said, well, you know, family isn't that important. But then it became much, much more. And the family started realizing that, wait a minute, there's something off about this. But it was hard to accept that, because here's someone you love, someone who's in the family, who's now, from your perspective, behaving inappropriately with your daughter, but you don't want to believe it. So there was this kind of building awareness, building horror, ongoing denial.
You don't recognize this behavior when it's right in front of you. Children don't recognize it because they don't know any difference. It's the only parent they know. And even people around don't recognize it because it's sort of incremental and some of it borderlines on just strange. And so we really sort of wanted to walk people through that dynamic, which a lot of us who haven't been through it don't really understand.
It's almost as if you need it for our social and medical understanding of sexual abuse to kind of catch up with this story. I mean, by and large, we don't think about abuse in the same way we did in the 90s.
Yes and no. I mean, I do think to some extent we do still think about abuse the way we thought about it in the 90s. I mean, the courts, more often than not, still send children back to their offending parent. And that's a legacy of this Woody Allen case.
Right. This case is probably the most prominent case involving allegations of incest in this country for the last 50 years. And the way that it was covered and the spin that was around it, I think, influenced the way this country looked at allegations of incest for decades. And one of the things we found out when we looked into the story was there were a number of investigations, and a number of them, there was a very apparent cover-up that was going on. And so we hope that the truth coming out around this particular story actually has an impact on the entire culture about all the other stories of incest that are going on, the millions of survivors of incest that are, you know, in this country today.
Yeah, and if for those that watch the series, you'll see how the defense that Woody launched became the playbook for the defense that many, many, many other persons accused of abuse used, which is to, when you're accused, you accuse the other parent of lying. And so it obfuscates and it completely confuses people, and it's extremely effective.
The depiction of Woody Allen and his relationship with Mia Farrow's other daughter, Suni, It was discovered the two were in a relationship when Suni was in college, but Woody had known her and sort of been a father figure since she was a young girl. And this doc actually questions whether the narrative of Woody being so in love with her is actually false. This is one of the other big revelations of this documentary.
Yeah, again, we hope people watch because what we were told, you know, and what actually happened is very, very, very different. And I found that part shocking as well. And I also want, since we're talking about how we hope this like has people reflect on incest, I also hope that it has people reflect on our use of the words adopted children. I mean, I realized, you know, an epiphany that went off in making this was, in all the press, it's always Dylan, the adopted daughter, you know, Suni, the adopted daughter. I mean, how does that subtly make us sort of think, okay, well, maybe the crime isn't so bad? Like, how weird and creepy is that? Somehow, like, if you're adopted, then if a parent transgresses boundaries, you know, maybe it's not that big a deal, you know? I just found that sort of startling, like watching all the archival footage, even the newsprint today, you know? So, yes, we do document rigorously the nature of Woody's relationship to all the children from a very, very early age, and you can draw your own conclusions after that.
We are really at a moment, it seems, where we are reassessing the past, our beliefs. We're assessing the amount of power and privilege certain people have. Why do you think this documentary is important for us to watch, especially now?
Well, I think we have a long way to go. Certainly post-Me Too, a moment Amy and I never thought we would see, actually. This country is looking at issues of sexual assault in a different way, and there is much more understanding of the issue and much more realization that most people, the vast majority of people who come forward are telling the truth. But there is still a lot of misunderstanding about this issue. There's a lot of biases. There's a lot of misogyny. And there's a lot of blowback about this. It's really important for stories like these to get out so that people understand much more what survivors experience, what the truth of these kind of situations are, and so that we can set up a culture and a society where this happens much less often.
Kirby Dick and Amy Ziering are the directors of the new documentary series, Allen vs. Pharaoh. It begins Sunday on HBO. Thank you both.
Thank you.
A new controversy over The Bachelor has reignited the reality franchise's problematic history with race and racism. For the first time in 19 years, the show has a Black bachelor, Matt James. But one of the contestants, Rachel Kirkconnell, apologized this week for what she calls offensive and racist actions after photos of her from 2018 attending a plantation-themed party resurfaced. Chris Harrison, the longtime host of the show, tried to downplay all of this during an interview with Rachel Lindsay, a former bachelorette.
It's not a good look.
No, it's not a good... Well, Rachel, is it a good look in 2018 or is it not a good look in 2021?
It's because not a good look ever because she's celebrating the Old South. If I went to that party, what would I represent at that party?
Since that interview, Harrison has announced he's taking a break as the host. And Rachel Lindsay, who was the show's first Black bachelorette, says she's now distancing herself from the show. Let's bring in NPR TV critic Eric Deggans for more on the bigger implications of this. And Eric, even if The Bachelor can recover the season after losing their host, what does this scandal tell you about the state of the show?
Well, I've been a longtime critic of the show. I've talked about how it's centered on white culture, how it's harder for contestants of color to compete because they have to deal with this marginalization of people of color. All of that said, this was a season that hasn't been doing as well in the ratings as the show normally does. And part of me wonders if this is a cynical move to attract attention.
Oh, interesting.
And then part of me thinks this just points out how pervasive racism is in America.
Outside of reality television, it's reflecting reality.
You know, reality television, I even hate that term. These producers control everything that happens. What's real is that racism and racially problematic stuff is so pervasive that the shows really have to do a better job of vetting these contestants. They have to learn that these issues are important and that they become huge scandals and that they can damage the show. As a critic and reporter, I've approached ABC, I've approached Chris Harrison, I've even approached Rachel Lindsay to talk about what's going on. And it's disappointing that the network and the studio that makes the show and the Harrison himself won't talk to independent journalists like myself to just put it on the table. What's going on? And why does the show keep making these mistakes? And how can it get back on track?
Well, 19 years is a really long time for a show to run. Do you think that what we might also be seeing is sort of the phasing out of this kind of show?
Well, number one, it still remains a popular show. The show's been around a while, but, you know, Survivor's been on for a long time. Big Brother's been on for a long time. American Idol has been around for a long time with a break in the middle. The length of the show is not really an excuse. They can change what they're doing. And in fact, people have been talking about the show's problems with race for many years. And if they were willing to listen and really address it rather than try to look like they were addressing it so that people would stop criticizing them, I think they would have, you know, done a better job and we wouldn't be having these conversations today.
Okay, with the few minutes I have with you, you mentioned American Idol. There is a contestant that's causing quite a bit of controversy, Claudia Conway, the daughter of Trump advisor Kellyanne Conway and anti-Trump lawyer George Conway. She auditioned. She made it to the next round. Prior to all of this, she had been in the news for feuding with her mom, and American Idol capitalized on all of it. Here she is talking with one of the show's judges, Katy Perry.
With your mom being the figure that she is, do you still, like, does she still hug you?
I mean, yeah, she loves me. I love her. It's just, I feel like our relationship's a little iffy. Most of my life, my feelings had been suppressed. Yeah. So then I got social media, and I was like, well, damn. Now my voice is being heard, you know?
Okay, Eric, American Idol has always milked contestants' personal stories. Why are so many objecting to how they handled Claudia Conway?
Well, I think if you watched her over the last few years of the Trump administration, you get the sense that this is a family that may be in crisis, and this is a kid in particular who may be struggling with parents that are fighting in a very public space, and she's asserting herself in a public space, and she's becoming a media star. And again, as we've seen with these reality shows, one thing they count on is controversy to get people to watch the show. You know, it feels very cynical to allow someone like that, who the political press has tried to handle with sensitivity, and just sort of thrust her in the harsh spotlight of an American Idol audition. And then, of course, you know, there's all the questions of, if she wasn't Claudia Conway, would she have really been considered? Or were they trying to trade on her media fame as opposed to whether or not she's a decent singer? Mm-hmm. It just makes you wonder if they really thought through the implications of having somebody who seems to be having a family crisis in public, having her on their show and somehow looking like they're trying to capitalize on the trauma that they're going through.
So much here. Thank you so much. That's NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Have a good weekend.
As always, it's been a pleasure. Thanks.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.